In our contract. So that's something that we have negotiated about. And I don't know if it's necessarily the case that we want the mayor of a city of 2.5 million people, you know, negotiating that level of detail. But when we get to the big issues, the transcendent issues about whether we can have enforceable caps on class size or reduce class sizes, whether or not we can have nurses, social workers, and other critical staffing needs, whether teacher time is protected, pay and benefits. If those issues the mayor wants to come in on and do the right thing, then that will be appreciated.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Jesse Sharkey, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. In breaking news, the State Department—
Can I say one more thing, Amy?
10 seconds.
Yeah, just solidarity with the UAW. We're rooting in, for the members of the UAW, and just want to express our solidarity with that struggle.
Jesse Sharkey, thanks so much. This breaking news, the State Department has ordered Gordon Sondland, the key figure in the House impeachment inquiry, not to testify to lawmakers today. Sondland's lawyer said in a statement, Sondland is profoundly disappointed he will not testify before Congress today. We'll have the latest on the impeachment inquiry against President Trump tomorrow. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, and Maria Tarasena. Miguel Nguyen, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Special thanks to Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
It's 5 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th at the Dismantle Change Build Center in Portland. Alex Vitale, director of the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project, is the author of The End of Policing. He'll be speaking on how to reconstruct police culture and behavior and describe alternatives that remove the police from dealing with drug addiction, houselessness, sex work, mental health crises, and more. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th, 6 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center, 14 Northeast Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Pursuing the City of Portland.
California has signed a bill to allow the distribution of HIV prevention drugs without a prescription.
And the White House announces they will not cooperate with the impeachment investigation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 8th, 2019. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Three Portlanders who were injured during a 2018 protest have joined together to sue the City of Portland and Portland Police Bureau officers. The complaint, filed on Monday, accuses the city of allowing its officers to use violent and unnecessary tactics to suppress the demonstrators' free speech. The joint lawsuit names James Maddox, Aaron Cantu, and Tracy Molina as plaintiffs. All three were participants in a counter-protest to the August 4, 2018 Gibson for Senate Freedom March, a demonstration in Portland organized by Patriot Prayer founder Joey Gibson. On the day of the protest, hundreds gathered to oppose Patriot Prayer's far-right rhetoric and threats of violence. However, according to the lawsuit, the main violence that took place came instead from Portland's own police force. The complaint focuses on one specific moment during the chaotic demonstration, when officers decided to fire so-called less lethal munitions into a crowd of counter-protesters near Southwest Columbia and NATO Parkway. In reports written after the incident, officers say they were responding to protesters who were throwing rocks and smashing police car windows. However, PPB has been unable to provide evidence supporting these claims. The plaintiffs have accused the city of Portland and its officers of violating the 4th and 14th Amendments by using excessive force with little provocation and violating the First Amendment by using violence to silence protected speech. They also accuse the city of negligence, battery, false arrest, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. The suit reads in part, quote, "Without adequate training, supervision, or review of PPB's officers, defendant City of Portland has created an environment of militarized responses to mild forms of dissent. Additionally, by firing their lethal weapons directly into a passive crowd, agents of City of Portland created an unnecessary and unreasonable risk of harm against all present." The plaintiffs, represented by three separate attorneys, have requested a jury trial.
The team of academics hired by the City of Portland, Rosenbaum and Associates, has given a favorable report regarding the Department of Justice required changes in the police department reporting. Quote, "In sum, we believe this group is engaging effectively with the community and PPB and has the authority to hold the PPB accountable for tactics and strategies linked to public trust." In 2012, the Department of Justice investigated the Portland Police Bureau for excessive use of force against people of color and the mentally ill. An agreement was reached with the DOJ in 2014 that called for multiple changes to reduce police involvement in violence through auditing and training. Since that time, the police have worked to restructure training practices and how they engage with the public. Police are also regularly receive feedback from the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. This new report, which covers July through October 2nd of this year, will be presented at a town hall on October 22nd at 5:30 p.m. at the New Song Community Church in Northeast Portland. The public is invited to attend and share their feedback and concerns.
California has become the first state in the nation to make HIV prevention drugs available without prescription. Under a bill signed into law on Monday by Governor Gavin Newsom, pharmacists in California will be able to dispense HIV PrEP and PEP drugs without a prescription. Senate Bill 159 will expand access to the prevention drugs, as backers of the bill say the need to obtain a prescription is a barrier for many people. The bill allows pharmacists to provide at least a 30-day supply and up to a 60-day supply of drugs used for pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, without a prescription. It also authorizes pharmacists to provide a full course of drugs used for post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP. PrEP involves the daily consumption of a drug by people who are HIV negative to prevent them from becoming infected with the virus if exposed. PEP is the administration of drugs to prevent HIV infection after a person has been exposed. The drugs must be taken within 72 hours after exposure and continued for 28 days. The bill also prohibits insurance companies from subjecting anti-HIV drugs to prior authorization or step therapy, which requires a patient to take cheaper alternatives to the drug prescribed. The bill will go into effect in California on January 1st.
Two suspects were identified and arrested in the murder of witness Joshua Brown. Joshua Brown gave testimony on behalf of the prosecution in the murder trial of former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger. The off-duty police officer Geiger shot and killed Jean Botham in his apartment after stating she entered his apartment in error on September 6th of 2018. The jury deliberated for a little over an hour on October 2nd before rendering a unanimous decision to sentence the former police officer for 10 years. The maximum sentence allowable was 99 years. Last Friday, Joshua Brown, who was the key witness for the prosecution, was found dead just 10 days after he delivered his emotional testimony in the Amber Geiger murder trial. Today, the Dallas police identified Thaddeus Green and Michael Mitchell as persons wanted in the homicide of Joshua Brown. The murder of Joshua Brown made headlines and sparked speculation about the involvement of the Dallas Police Department in the death. The Dallas police have denied any wrongdoing, and the chief of police, Avery Moore, issued a press release today discounting the speculation as rumors.
The White House announced today that it would refuse to cooperate with the congressional impeachment inquiry. White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said in a statement that the executive branch would not be cooperating with the impeachment investigation. This includes the White House, the Justice Department, and the State Department. The White House also argued that in order to make the impeachment investigation valid, Democrats would need to give Republican ranking members the authority to issue subpoenas. Lawyer Pat Cipollone said in a letter to Democratic House leaders, quote, "Your unprecedented actions have left the president with no choice. In order to fulfill his duties to the American people, the Constitution, the executive branch, and all future occupants of the office of the presidency, President Trump and his administration cannot participate in your partisan and unconstitutional inquiry under these circumstances." This is just the latest example of the White House's strategy of almost universal resistance in order to suppress the impeachment inquiry.
The State Department, under the direction of the White House, has ordered Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the U.K., not to testify before three House committees. Sondland was scheduled to testify this morning and had flown from Brussels yesterday for that purpose. Then, just hours before he was set to be deposed, the order came down that he should not attend. House committee members will now subpoena Ambassador Sondland to testify to what he knows about Trump's effort to make the Ukraine investigate Joe Biden in exchange for military aid. Trump tweeted this morning, quote, "I would love to send Ambassador Sondland, a really good man and a great American, to testify, but unfortunately he would be testifying before a totally compromised kangaroo court where Republicans' rights have been taken away," end quote. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff was quick to respond that preventing Sondland from testifying amounted to obstruction of justice.
A new poll conducted by the Washington Post, along with the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, has found that a majority of U.S. citizens support impeachment proceedings by the House of Representatives. The inquiry, which was announced by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, is the result of a whistleblower's complaint that a phone call made by Trump to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was unlawful. During the call, Trump asked Zelensky to begin an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. Before requesting the investigation, Trump threatened to withhold military aid to Ukraine, which had already been allocated by Congress, an act he is not empowered to do. The poll shows that two-thirds of citizens believe the phone call was not appropriate. The poll also found that 3 in 10 Republicans support the proceedings, as well as 57% of independents and 86% of Democrats. They also found that 3 in 5 people believe that Trump does not uphold proper standards of ethics in government.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos could face jail time after a judge said she was violating a court order by continuing to collect student debts on a now-defunct school. The ruling from June of 2018 was made by U.S. Magistrate Judge Sally Kim and prevents DeVos and the Department of Education from going after former students of the bankrupt Corinthian Colleges, Inc. However, the judge said she was astounded to discover that DeVos was violating the court order after filing by the Education Department disclosed more than 16,000 former students were, quote, "incorrectly informed at one time or another that they had payments due on their federal student loans," end quote. According to the filing, at least 1,800 people reportedly lost wages or tax refunds. The judge said, quote, "At best, it is gross negligence. At worst, it's an international flouting of my order. I'm not sure if this is contempt or sanctions. I'm not sending anyone to jail yet, but it's good to know that I have that ability," end quote. The judge also ordered the lawsuit against DeVos to go full steam ahead and told lawyers for both camps to procure the relevant filings to assist her in ruling whether DeVos is, in fact, in contempt of court.
International security officials have concluded that Russia's intelligence service is operating a coordinated and ongoing campaign to destabilize Europe. The operation is being executed by an elite unit inside the Russian intelligence system, skilled in subversion, sabotage, and assassination. The group, known as Unit 29155, has operated for at least a decade. However, officials only recently discovered it. Intelligence officials in four countries say the unit is within the command hierarchy of the Russian Military Intelligence Agency, widely known as the GRU. Although much about GRU activities remains a mystery, American officials say two GRU cyber units hacked into the servers of the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign and then published internal communications. Last year, Special Counsel Robert Mueller indicted more than a dozen officers from those units, though all remain at large as their teams mostly operate from Moscow, thousands of miles from their targets. Intelligence agencies first identified this threat after the failed 2016 coup in Montenegro, which involved a plot by two unit officers to kill the country's prime minister and seize the parliament building. The unit's specific agenda of disruption became clear after the March 2018 poisoning in Britain of former spy Sergei Skripal. Skripal and his daughter fell gravely ill after exposure to a highly toxic nerve agent, but survived. So, European security officials are also perplexed by the apparent sloppiness in the unit's operations. Skripal survived the assassination attempt, and the coup in Montenegro ultimately failed. It is hard to say if the failures have bothered the Kremlin, but perhaps, intelligence experts say, that is part of the point. Eric Niles Cross, a former intelligence chief in Estonia, said, quote, "That kind of intelligence operation has become part of the psychological warfare. They want to be felt. It's part of the game."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with a high of 59 degrees. Today in history. In 2001, the Office of Homeland Security is founded less than 1 month after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Now a cabinet department, Homeland Security is one of the largest divisions of the federal government. The quote of the day is from American abolitionist and journalist William Lloyd Garrison, who said, quote, "Is error through unwittingly supported by a host of good men stronger than truth? Are right and wrong convertible terms dependent upon popular opinion?" End quote.
According to research and consulting firm Anderson Economic Group, the General Motors strike is estimated to have hit as many as 150,000 workers in the auto industry. The strike began on September 16th with 48,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union seeking higher pay, greater job security, a bigger share of the automaker's profits, and protection of health care benefits. Since then, about 75,000 employees of auto parts suppliers have either been temporarily laid off or have seen their wages shrink due to the decrease in demand from GM. According to Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency, about 5,000 auto workers in the state have filed for unemployment benefits as a result of the strike. The firm estimates that the strike has resulted in a $660 million profit loss for GM and more than $412 million in direct wage losses for all employees through the third week of the strike. GM's share price has lost 9% since the strike began, cutting more than $4 billion from the company's market value. United Auto Workers Vice President and Director Terry Deitz said, quote, "We continue to meet with the company and are still not in agreement on key issues such as wages and health care."
The FBI has announced that after years of investigation, it has been able to verify 50 of the 93 killings of the convicted murderer Samuel Little has confessed to, making him the most prolific killer in U.S. history. Little, who was serving three consecutive life sentences in California, began confessing to the murders in 1994 when a Texas Ranger approached him about a cold case in Odessa. After this, The FBI's Violent Apprehension Program began interviewing him about other unsolved murders. In all, Little confessed to strangling 93 women between 1970 and 2005. FBI analyst Chrissy Palazzolo has said that Little thought he would never be caught because no one was accounting for his victims, who were mostly sex workers or drug addicts. Last year, Little was extradited to Texas and pled guilty to the killing of Denise Brothers in 1995. Little will spend the rest of his life in prison.
A new study on the greenest cities in the U.S. by the personal finance site WalletHub is out, and Portland is number 9 on the list. The study looked at 28 key indicators in the areas of environment, transportation, energy sources, lifestyle, and policy. Also included were factors such as air quality, number of people walking and biking, water quality, green spaces, and bans on plastic bags. The city that earned the number one spot on the list was San Francisco, while our neighbor to the north, Seattle, came in at number 6.
Young people are leading a demonstration against the Keystone XL pipeline, and native groups applaud a park's decision to stop selling pipes. With that story and more, it's National Native News, the only daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two 16-year-olds led hundreds of people in a march against the Keystone XL pipeline in South Dakota on Monday. They demonstrated outside the Rapid City Mayor's office about the pipeline's environmental impact. China Lockett has more.
Climate what?
Climate crisis!
Dakota Iron Eyes chants a question. Then Greta Thunberg and hundreds of others follow. The rally is full of teenagers supporting these young leaders. Iron Eyes says there's power in mobilizing and voting in democracies.
What are the things right now that are causing this crisis? Because it is not just one person. It is not just one corporation. All of us as humanity have a responsibility to do something personally. It is a personal choice.
Iron Eyes protests against the now completed Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock. Now she's hoping to prevent the Keystone XL pipeline. She asks the crowd to sit.
Let's take a moment of silence for all of the lands and the waters that have already been destroyed. All of the irreversible destruction that has already been made.
The crowd is silent for a few minutes. Greta Thunberg says building pipelines is helping to raise the global temperature, and she's worried about all of their futures.
We cannot go on like this. We cannot continue to build new pipelines. That is insane.
The South Dakota legislature has taken steps to criminalize protests against the Keystone XL pipeline. Thunberg says people around the world are all dealing with climate change. When they support and listen to each other, she says things like pipelines and deforestation can be prevented.
These are just symptoms of a worldwide ecological and climate crisis, and we are all affected. We are all in the same boat. But of course, some are more affected than others. And we need to make sure that the voices of those who are at the front line are being heard.
President Donald Trump approved the Dakota Access Pipeline and Keystone XL Pipeline in 2017. For National Native News, I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
Native people in Minnesota are applauding the decision of a park to no longer sell items they hold sacred. After years of discussion and contention, Pipestone National Monument will no longer sell pipes on monument grounds. Emily Bright has more.
The decision comes after years of formal discussion between the U.S. government and the 23 tribes that have historically mined the Pipestone Quarry, located in southwest Minnesota. It's a complex issue. Selling the pipes carved from pipestone supports Native American craftspeople, but many consider the pipestone sacred and argue that it should not be sold. Faith Spotted Eagle is a chairperson of the Ehunktuan Treaty Steering Committee and a member of the Yankton Sioux Tribe. She called the decision to stop selling pipes the answer to decades of prayers.
It's a generational decision that has taken probably over 100 years to get to this point. So it's a day of celebration that we have somebody from the Park Service that can understand that we have a right to grieve what was lost and now has been heard, that we don't want our sacred items to be sold.
Pipestone carving will continue at the monument as part of the cultural demonstration program. Other Native American-made items, including small pipestone crafts, will continue to be sold at the store, along with additional information about their significance. Emily Bright, National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
There's outrage in Arizona after video footage captured border wall construction bulldozers plowing over protected cacti in Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument. The park is a U.S. National Monument, a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, and is also sacred land for indigenous groups like the Tohono O'odham Nation. The video shows the bulldozers running over the National Monument and clearing saguaros in order to build a costly and unnecessary wall on the U.S. southern border. The video was taken by Kevin Dahl, who works at the National Parks Conservation Association. This video stands in sharp contrast to another posted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which showed a different process, where a cactus is carefully removed with designated extraction tools and relocated, as opposed to being plowed over by a bulldozer. Like in Jordal, Borderlands campaigner with the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, "The Department of Homeland Security says they're relocating cacti, but the videos we shot at the construction site tell a very different story, one of flattened earth and total devastation. Even if they do relocate some specimens, any remediation will pale in comparison to the severe and lasting damage done by the wall, stadium lights, and enforcement zone."
Officials in Madrid, Spain, have announced plans to reduce the number of parakeets in the city. The city council announced the plan after a recent survey showed the parakeet population had grown from 9,000 birds in 2016 to 12,000 birds today. In 2005, there were less than 2,000 birds. The birds are native to Argentina, but many were imported to Spain as pets before ownership was outlawed 8 years ago. Officials say the swelling population needs to be brought down as the birds are threatening biodiversity by competing with other species for food and damaging the environment by stripping vegetation to build their nests. According to a statement from the city council, parakeet nests can weigh up to 200 kilograms, or about 440 pounds, which is a threat to the branches that support them, and also the people on whom they fall. They also say the birds pose a public health risk, as they can pass illnesses such as parrot fever, avian flu, and salmonella onto humans. City authorities are working with the Spanish Ornithological Society and will begin humane slaughter and egg sterilization over the coming months. The council did not reveal how many parakeets would be targeted, but they said it would not eradicate the entire population.
Biologists want to protect sparrow nests from flooding as sea levels rise. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In salt marshes along the southeastern U.S. coast, you may hear the call of McGillivray's seaside sparrows. These tiny birds build their nests in marsh grass.
But as the sea level rises, their nests get flooded more and more often, which causes the death of their offspring, and so they have to start all over when they're nesting.
Karina Newsom is a graduate student at Georgia Southern University. She says that when a sparrow's nest is flooded, it builds its next nest higher up off the ground.
But the problem with that is that when they build their nests higher, they are more visible to predators.
Like mink, rice rats, and raccoons. So near Brunswick, Georgia, Newsom is using cameras to monitor the birds' nests and predator activity.
My project is focusing on understanding how predation threat varies across their breeding habitat.
She says her study will give wildlife managers information they can use to better protect sparrows. For example, by building structures that shield sensitive areas.
There is hope because there are a variety of management strategies that can be employed
to help seaside sparrows have a better chance of surviving as the climate changes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The governors of the Great Lakes states are liming the amount of water that can be removed from the Great Lakes Basin. With more on this story, it's Current Cast.
When sharing is not caring. On this Current Cast. We've always been taught to share, but the eight Great Lakes states have a legal pact that limits the sharing of their most valuable resource, water.
Even though there's a lot of water in the Great Lakes, it's not a limitless resource. It's a resource that we depend on in the Great Lakes region to support our economy and our way of life.
That's Molly Flanagan of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. She says the agreement is called the Great Lakes Compact. It tightly restricts water withdrawals from the Great Lakes Basin and requires the surrounding states to closely monitor their water use.
The Great Lakes governors really wanted to make sure that it was a resource that was protected for our use today and for future generations.
Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 8th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn and Rochelle Dixon. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up Wednesday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with host Jacqueline Keeler. At 9, it's Radio Zine. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Dirtbag host Glenn Andreessen welcomes back Jim Gilbert. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then just download the mobile app today. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio and to the KBOO Evening News. My name is Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
And this show is Totality of Circumstances. We're on every 2 weeks, Tuesday at 5:30. And we take a holistic look at policing, police-community relations, the issues that surround police from a local level up to a national level.
And this week we're looking at something that has a huge impact on policing culture and communities. We're looking at the district attorney. For the first time in Multnomah County in almost 40 years, voters will be choosing a district attorney from a competitive field of candidates. There are currently three people running, all of whom have previously worked in the district attorney's office, either in Multnomah County or in another Oregon county.
Oregon DA for the People is a coalition of community groups working towards criminal justice reform. On Labor Day this year, they unveiled a 6-point platform informed by national and local efforts to pressure DAs into using their power for good. And we are very excited to have on the show today Maria Cahill and Mark Woodleaf, who are two local activists involved in the coalition's efforts.
I'm Maria Cahill. I'm a volunteer organizer with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, and I use they, them pronouns.
My name is Mark Woodleaf, and I am with the coalition Oregon DA for the People, and I use he, him pronouns.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about the coalition and the campaign that you are working on, Oregon DA for the People. And so how did the two of you come to be involved in this particular work?
I was working with Pacific Northwest Family Circle when Black Lives Matter action group from Showing Up for Racial Justice Portland came to us and said, we are looking for a big project to work on, and we want to work on it with you. We've, you know, done our strategic plan, and we're committed to your organization for at least 2 years. And so we said, great. What we've been working on is district attorney accountability, and through the Feet to Fire, the National Feet to Fire campaign. So we are our own organization within Oregon and Washington, and then we are also the Oregon chapter of Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit, Michigan. And Yolanda McNair out there organizes a monthly protest in front of the district attorney's office to raise awareness about the power of the district attorney and their ability to change police culture in the counties. So we started in 2017, one of the earliest Feet to Fire campaigns. We jumped right in. We were the first chapter of POST, and the first like subchapter of POST, and then the first people to do that with them. So we've been focusing on this a long time. And when Serge came to us and said, "What do you want to do?" This is what we said: district attorney accountability. Why don't you call around to the other Serges that have gotten wins, and specifically Philly was what came to our mind, right? Philly, Larry Krasner in Philly. How did Larry Krasner get elected? And so they went off and they did that, and they said they built a platform and a coalition around the platform. And Surge Portland Black Lives Matter Action Group has been working on the platform ever since, and we released it on September 2nd, on Labor Day. So we are actually only involved. We also guided through the lived experience of our families. We also guided one sixth of the platform. So our platform area is hold police and prosecutors accountable. And other organizations or other people with lived experience in these other realms, which I'm sure we'll get into soon, have informed those demands of the district attorney.
And Mark, could you tell us a little bit about what work Surge has been doing over the years in Portland, and how you came to be involved in this campaign?
Personally, I'd rather not speak for Surge, okay, because personally, I came to this campaign through volunteer work with Real Justice PAC, which is Sean King's organization that began to locate the district attorney as a focal point for shaping and making a better legal system, and in particular a decarceral legal system. So I did some volunteer work with Real Justice. I had been involved peripherally with Surge, and then once Surge Black Lives Matter subgroup got Oregon DA for the People going, I saw a good fit for me to jump in.
Great, thank you. That's a good link into the platform that you released recently, or that Oregon DA for the People released recently. Mm-hmm. And there's 6 points: stop targeting Black, Brown, Indigenous, and immigrant communities, end mass incarceration, decline to prosecute individuals with mental health conditions, treat kids like kids, hold police and prosecutors accountable, and decriminalize houselessness, sex work, and drug use. And Maria, you mentioned that you worked with people on the holding police and prosecutors accountable branch of this platform.
Yeah, so Pacific Northwest Family Circle started in 2016 when Irene Kalonji's son, the idea for it started when Irene Kalonji's son was murdered by Clackamas County sheriffs in January. And 4 months later, another mother had lost her son to Gresham police violence. This is Shiloh Wilson Phelps. The two of them, when Irene heard about how Shiloh's son, Bodie Phelps, had been killed by police, she knew that she needed to connect with her. She knew the pain, at least some of the pain, that Shiloh was feeling. And the two of them did connect. She prayed on it, and she made the connection. And together, they said, yes, we need to join families together who don't want to, who are unwilling to stay silent about this murdering that's going on by police. So I was there from the beginning telling Irene, I'm here to be your organizational backbone if you want to do that. So since then, we have 18 families and 19 loved ones who've been, two loved ones who are alive and were harmed by police, were shot and harmed by police, and one, and then the rest of the family, the rest of the loved ones were killed by police. Our families are in, either our families are in Oregon and Washington, or the loved ones are in Oregon and Washington, and the families say, you know, to be a part of our organization, that they're willing to let us use their stories. So that is how we've been changing policies and laws, is through storytelling and through the lived experience of our family members. So we saw early on when the ACLU took Irene Kalonji down to the legislature in Salem, how effective that was. She told the story of how Christopher had been killed in front of the legislature when they were trying to decide whether or not to pass the district attorney accountability law of recording the all of the grand juries and making them public. And that law was a law that advocates have been trying to pass for 30 years. And there were a lot of things that made that law ripe to pass that year, but we believe that the storytelling was a part of that. And so that's the role that we play, is bringing the lived experience of family members to inform policies and laws and regulations.
Just to piggyback on that, I think that centering the stories of loved ones and family members is absolutely crucial.
I've been to a couple of events for the Pacific Northwest Family Circle, including one that was Oregon DA for the People, that was a storytelling event at PSU. What strikes me about a lot of the similarities between the stories is this, target isn't the right word, but is each of the family members kind of individually arriving at the conclusion that the DA is the person that needs to be held accountable. And I'm wondering if you could share maybe an example with us about how that might play out in the life of someone whose loved one has been killed by police.
Definitely. So the district attorney is the first person that has any real power that our families interact with after their loved one is killed by police. And for Donna Hayes, who's the grandmother of Quanis Hayes, also known as Moose, we call him Moose Hayes. That was his name from day one. So, Moose was shot three times, but the DA lied about it and said that he was shot twice. And then it came out later that it was three times. They weren't allowed to see his body. When they went into the district attorney's office to identify Moose, the district attorney just took a photo of Moose and flung it across the table at them. And that was how they were invited to identify his body. So, the way they learned about the death of their loved one is through Facebook.
Before we get into the actual election itself, the DA is part of a much larger criminal justice system and does hold a lot of power locally. So what do you think that a progressive DA, should they be elected, would be able to accomplish on their own?
I think we hope, as the Oregon DA for the People Coalition, we hope that they will be able to officially endorse our platform, which you read the 6 points, and at least, and if you look further at the website, OregonDAForThePeople.com, you will find that there are more explicit demands about within the first 100 days committing to stop targeting Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities and committing to end mass incarceration. So that's to begin or not just begin to end, but to end the school-to-prison pipeline, which has to do with the incarceration or criminalization of kids. And that's what we think a progressive DA can and will do, just to name a few things.
Yeah, and to highlight one thing from the website that we saw, you make the point that the culture of policing itself is very much influenced by the tendencies of the local district attorney.
We definitely believe that the district attorney can change the culture of policing in the county. The DA decides who gets tried and what kind of sentencing they may receive, and often overriding judges in sentencing. And to that end, you know, just as one example, to end mass incarceration, they could just tell the police, don't arrest houseless people anymore. Let's institute a culture around who we are and aren't going to arrest anymore, so that people just don't even come into the system.
I think that's exactly right. I think a cultural change, broadly speaking, a cultural change is absolutely one thing that we expect from a progressive district attorney.
You know, decline to prosecute mental health. That's yeah. A choice that the district attorney makes on their own.
We're talking about Multnomah County and Clackamas County, but this is a national, I don't think movement
focus.
Is too,
yeah, yeah,
I don't think movement is too strong a word.
Yeah.
We've got Larry Krasner, we've got Tiffany Caban in Queens, New York, who did not win, but was within dozens of votes of winning. Hmm. Wesley Bell in St. Louis. So it is a national movement to decarcerate. I have a little rhyme that I like to say. 2, 4, 6, 8. I want to decarcerate.
Yeah, and can we just talk briefly about the word progressive?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, because I really don't care how you describe the next district attorney. We have Portland and Oregon. I love these places. I'm not from here, but I'm just gonna say, with my like critical thinking cap on, that I have noticed that we really like to say things about ourselves that simply are not true. We like to say that we are progressive. If this is progress, where the number of police shootings and police killings continue to go up at an alarming rate in 2019 in the city of Portland, Oregon, I think we need to stop assuming that when someone says they're progressive, that they actually will do the things that we are asking them to do, that the things that we all believe as decent human beings, other decent human beings are doing. We make a lot of assumptions about that. I know I did before I got involved in this work just 5 years ago. So I think we all have a lot to learn, and I think we really need to focus on what people are doing. And so if the candidates endorse the platform, that's great. I'm not going to call them progressive. I'm going to say they endorsed our platform. And now we know one single thing about what they said. And when they get elected, we will know whether or not they're actually going to do these things. And if they endorse the platform and they don't do these things, our coalition is going to be around in 4 years to make sure that someone else gets a chance to show that they are really going to do the things that our community needs them to do to stay safe. I talk about public safety and public health. The district attorney the actions of the district attorney are deeply connected to both of those things. We are in danger from police violence as long as the district attorney is protecting them.
A lot of people across the country don't know who their district attorney even is. In Multnomah County, currently it's Rod Underhill. Speaking of what you said about the word progressive, and in some contexts, Rod Underhill could probably pass himself off as a progressive district attorney. Mm-hmm. But could you, in those terms of like what he has done and what his track record shows, what can you tell us about his track record on the issues that are represented in your platform?
No police officer has been under Rod Underhill's district attorneyship has been held accountable for violence against James Chassie or
Terrell Johnson.
Exactly.
Quanis Hayes. Bradley Morgan. We could go on and on.
We can.
Bodie Phelps.
I think it's worth mentioning that since 1980, there have been two district attorneys in Multnomah County, Rod Underhill and then his predecessor, Mike Shrunk, who was the son of Mayor Terry Shrunk of Shrunk Plaza mm-hmm. fame. And so that's another thing that the Oregon DA for the People platform really highlights is that these people hold a tremendous amount of power, but there's very little turnover. They tend to get in there for their four-year term and then stay there, oftentimes running unopposed for decades. Mike Shrunk, I think, in his almost 30-year term, had two challengers or one challenger in that period.
So only once did he ever have to say publicly what he thought about any of these issues. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Yeah.
For our listeners who want to be able to make informed decisions, how would you recommend that they go about informing themselves, educating themselves about these three candidates?
You've got to read. You've got to study. There are some upcoming candidate forums that will be very important. They are October 26th for Clackamas County, October 27th for Multnomah County. We specifically, along with other community partners, will be asking the candidates about their accountability and about their plans.
I want to add to that that to stay up to date, you can go to OregonDAForThePeople.com. And you can sign up for updates from us. So we definitely encourage everyone to get information from all sorts of places. But if you want information from us, go to OregonDAForThePeople.com. We'll keep you up to date on, for instance, when candidates, you know, drop out and when they're added. We're certainly hoping that the mere presence of this platform and the fact that people are signing up to endorse it as individuals and as organizations will be a cue to lawyers throughout. I don't care. You don't have to be from this county to run for the district attorney. So let's say lawyers from throughout Oregon who might be interested in becoming our district attorney. We want as many candidates as possible, and we want good candidates who know that the community is behind them. Whoever they are, we're hoping to have, you know, many, many candidates endorse this platform. And in order to do that, in order to convince them that we have a movement, it's helpful for people to sign up for updates on the newsletter, even if you don't want to endorse the platform. But if you do want to endorse the platform, that's also helpful. We can tell these candidates we have so many people that are interested in this and so many people that are interested in that. And it lets them know that we are here to hold them accountable and also to support them. You know, I think it was Sam earlier made a great point. This is one person in a very broken system. And so we think there are things we know that there are things that the district attorney can do on their own, and we also know that we have to be here for the long term to support those people who have proven their worthiness of our support through their actions, and help them navigate that very broken system.
Have the three Multnomah County candidates all confirmed for the candidate forum?
No, they have not.
Have any of them?
I think that Mike Schmidt has confirmed. So I will say our organization is not endorsing a district attorney candidate at this time. Our organization being Pacific Northwest Family Circle, of course, the coalition, Oregon DA for the People, will never do that. The purpose of the coalition is to have democracy, in short, right, in the district attorney's office. But Pacific Northwest Family Circle, we are certainly holding off on an endorsement, but we likely will endorse a candidate next year. And right now, we are inviting all of the district attorney candidates in Multnomah and Clackamas County to come to our monthly meetings and speak to us. And Mike Schmidt did attend our monthly meeting, spent an hour and a half with us, as much time as we wanted and had to talk about his strategies and what he believed and what his lived experience was about why he's running for district attorney. And so we're hoping that Ethan Knight and Kirsten Nato will also accept our invitations. Donna Hayes is, as soon as Donna Hayes gets the contact information of anyone in a position of power, she is like a bulldog on their ankle. So I feel sure they're going to come see us, and I feel sure that they're all three of them are going to come to the candidates forum. But I don't think we have anyone absolutely confirmed at this time. So please, out there, people out there, if you know these folks, please encourage them to meet with organizations who have lived experience to share about their experience with the district attorney, which is what we did. We had a lot of things to tell Mike Schmidt when he came, and same when Ethan Knight and hopefully Kirsten Nato come. And encourage them to come to the candidates forum.
Thank you both very much for being here today. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add or that you'd like our listeners to know about?
I just want to reinforce that we vote for our district attorney in May of 2020. The election is for that office is absolutely over in the primary. And encourage people to sign up for updates and to endorse the platform. Those are our takeaways.
Well said.
OregonDAForThePeople.com.
We've been talking with Maria Cahill and with Mark Woodleaf. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
We appreciate it.
So again, we would like to thank Maria Cahill and Mark Woodleaf for coming on the show and talking to us today. If you'd like to connect with the DA for the People events, they'll be holding two different events at the end of October related to the upcoming DA races. There's only one candidate for DA in Clackamas County, so instead of holding a candidate forum, the coalition will be holding a listening session to give the community an opportunity to voice their priorities and concerns around district attorneys and their roles, and that will be from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Willamette Falls, located at 710 6th Street in Oregon City.
And that's on a Saturday. And the next day, Sunday, the Multnomah County Candidate Forum will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. at First Unitarian Church, which is at 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. For more information and to register for either of these events, you can go to Oregon DA for the People's website at www.OregonDAForThePeople.com. You can also visit the Pacific Northwest Family Circle Facebook page or website at pnwfamilycircle.org. And before we say goodbye today, we have a clarification from our last show. In our story about the history of arbitration between the police union and the city, we discussed the 1985 killing of Tony Stevenson by Portland police officer Gary Barber. At least one listener found our description to be incomplete, and we'd like to offer a little more detail.
If you didn't hear the show, we're going to repeat some of the information here, and we do want to tell people that this does discuss issues that may be hard to listen to. Stevenson was an off-duty security guard who helped stop a shoplifter at a 7-Eleven in Northeast Portland. When cops showed up, Stevenson was initially mistaken for the shoplifter by Barber and his partner before they were redirected to the actual shoplifter by the 7-Eleven employees. According to contemporary Oregonian articles, police arrested the shoplifter and then went back to Stevenson, who was arguing with two Shell gas station attendants who had crossed the street and involved themselves in the situation. There is a dispute of fact between police and witnesses as to what happened next and why, but the end result was that Barber choked Stevenson to death in the parking lot of that 7-Eleven. So we would, again, like to offer that clarification. These issues are always really complex and difficult, especially looking at things historically. And we appreciate the feedback from our listeners urging clarification and to really focus on and take time to describe these details. So please thank you for getting in touch with us, and please don't hesitate to get in touch with us again. And again, we'd like to thank Maria Cahill and Mark Woodleaf, and that's Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening, and you can reach out to us if you have any feedback or questions or concerns, or if you think we should all be quiet. You can contact us at totalityradio@gmail.com. Again, I'm Sam.
I'm Jasmine.
Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 6 p.m. at KBOO, and next up is Transpositive PDX with your host, Emma.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a public affairs director to manage public affairs programming, ensuring that it is of the highest quality and consistent with the KBOO programming charter. For this 32 hours position, we are looking for someone with production experience, experience in community radio, who has communication and training skills, and the ability to work independently in a fast-paced work environment. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Deadline to apply is Friday, October 25th at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PAD Hire 2019.